The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. On today's show, we're going to revisit some of the interview that President Obama had with The Atlantic last week. There's quite a few articles that continue to come along that have analyzed some of the bits and pieces from that interview. Also, I'd like to just discuss a little bit more about the German elections on Sunday. We discussed some of this yesterday, but there are a number of publications looking upon March 13th as a turning point in Germany. And then throughout this first segment, I'd like to also touch on an article written by Herbert Armstrong. This is from 1961, 55 years ago. I think this will fit in well with the spirit of He Was Right. We talked about the success of the program over the weekend that advertised that booklet, the program that played here in the UK, The Crisis at the Close. And as I mentioned yesterday, we had 240 requests for that booklet, He Was Right. And really, this 1961 article, you could put quite a number of the quotes in that article, in that booklet that we produced. He was right. He certainly was. And then you may have heard also an announcement yesterday coming out of Russia that they intend to pull their troops out of Syria. Evidently, the mission is accomplished for Russia. We'll look more closely at that coming up in the next segment. Well, on this day, 2,059 years ago, the Roman dictator Julius Caesar was assassinated by his friends and associates, and they feared his growing power, and they believed that Caesar needed to die for the good of Rome. This is in today's Telegraph. It says, as it happens, the murder of Caesar did turn out to be a key moment in history. You talk about a turning point. The Telegraph says, with Caesar gone, Rome spiraled into another cycle of civil wars, which resulted in one of the most significant constitutional transformations in history. The Eternal City abandoned its trademark republican system of government and became an empire. It became the fourth, looking at it from a prophetic standpoint, the fourth world-ruling empire, just as God had prophesied through the prophet Daniel and others. It's talked about, of course, this empire, this system, in the book of Revelation. The Roman Empire, as we've noted so many times before, it existed from 31 BC to AD 476. And at that point, the kingdom was crushed, but its deadly wound was healed, just as is prophesied in Revelation 13. When Justinian, Emperor Justinian, recognized the supremacy of the Pope in 554 AD. And then that empire sprung to life. And the Bible said there would be seven resurrections of the Roman Empire, called the Holy Roman Empire, a church-state union. We'll look again at some of these verses in Revelation 17 here in just a moment. But first, let me just take you to that 1961 article by Herbert Armstrong. Keep in mind, this is 55 years old, this article, written in September 1961. The title, Giant World Power Rising Out of Common Market. And he goes through some of this history, some of these dates I just mentioned. The original Roman Empire fell in 476 AD, but it was, say God's prophecies, to be resurrected seven times. Six of those revivals have come and gone. This is Mr. Armstrong writing in 1961. Today we see the seventh, the last resurrection springing to life. The first of these seven was Justinian's reign beginning in 554 AD. This was accomplished at the behest of the Pope of Rome. Justinian and his successors have all been crowned by popes in such case, or rather in each case, the church ruled over state. That's what's described here in Revelation 17 with this woman straddling the beast. But then it talks about just the desire of these nations in Europe, and this would be true too in our day, following the crushing of Germany in World War II, or there at the end. It says, all through these years, the nations of Europe have been wanting to unite, but impossible obstacles stood in their way. They distrusted one another. They each had ulterior designs against the others. As stated above, and I'll read some from the earlier part of this article a little bit later, but it says, Germany twice tried to eat its cake and have it too, by provoking two world wars in efforts to conquer not only the nations of Europe, but the whole world. And then it says here, again, this is in 1961, but today Germany is cut in two. East Germany is under communist domination against the common enemy, the USSR, dedicated to conquering and ruling the whole world. Britain and America began fostering ideas of a united Europe. I mean, Britain and America, going back to the 50s and 60s, they were behind this. They were pushing for this. Indeed, they push for it today. You have those comments yesterday from White House spokesman Josh Earnest saying that Britain should stay in, that Britain should stay in this union. Now, we know there's going to be a dramatic shaking of events in the continent, on Europe, that Europe's, or rather Britain's, going to be on the outside eventually. In any event, as Mr. Armstrong brings out here, Britain and America were the ones fostering these ideas decades ago. He says, yes, paradoxically, the very Frankenstein monster that prophecy warns is to destroy us has been proposed, encouraged, aided, and abetted by both the United States and Britain. It's been proposed, encouraged, aided, and abetted by our own nations. As we've propped up this empire, as you know, the United States was largely responsible for rebuilding Germany following the devastation at the end of World War II. So look at this verse here, verse 3 of Revelation 17. In this chapter, John, the Apostle John, describes this beast with seven heads, and he also describes a woman which symbolizes a great church. She's riding this beast. Verse 3, it says, so he carried me away in the spirit in the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and 10 horns. Seven heads. So there's seven specific stages culminating in this final union of 10 nations or groups of nations at the end of this age. 10 kings or 10 toes, to use what Daniel says there in chapter 2 of his prophecy. Down in verse 7, it says, and the angel said to me, wherefore did you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the seven heads and 10 horns. I'll give you the interpretation here. Just pay attention. Keep reading. Keep studying. Blessed are you if you read, it says at the beginning of Revelation. You're blessed if you dig into these prophecies. You're blessed if you study the words of God. So much of it's laid out there for us in advance, as I say. You read that article from 1961, that one by Mr. Armstrong, and you know right away in looking at events today that he was right. Never mind some of the little details here and there that make it seem dated, or the fact that maybe it didn't happen quite as soon as he was hoping, as we were all eagerly hoping for the return of Jesus Christ to this earth and the establishment of God's kingdom. But now here we are, and we're witnessing such dramatic prophecies unfold. You put these pieces together, as I say, it's all laid out there for us. And as I brought out, and I don't think it was in the program from this past weekend, but a few months ago, as we went through this signature prophecy, as we called it on that program, I noted how that there were there were quite a few commentaries going back 100, 150 years that understood clearly what this beast and what the woman riding the beast represented. But those messages were watered down over time. As the authors or as the scholars that put that material together became weak and timid, and they lacked the courage. They lacked the courage to warn the world, to tell you what God says will happen. That's why you need He Was Right, because that's a message coming from an end-time Elijah that is very strong and courageous and bold. There's nothing weak or timid about that booklet or about its message. You should also get the Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy. I mean, that's another one. Just a powerful warning message in the pages of these books. Verse 8 says, "The beast that you saw was and is not, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. And they that dwell on the earth shall wander, whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world. When they behold the beast that was and is not, and yet is," as we've explained many times before, Mr. Armstrong was on the scene at the time of the sixth head or the sixth resurrection. That's why it's worded the way it is here in this passage. He was on the scene. He saw the sixth head as it came to power, and after it was crushed, of course. And then he spent the rest of his ministry, again, proclaiming this signature prophecy about the seventh and final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. Notice verse 10, it says, "And there are seven kings, five are fallen, and one is, and the other is not yet come." See, again, that just puts Mr. Armstrong in the time frame here. "And when he's come, he must continue a short space." You see, there's another that would come on the scene after Mr. Armstrong's work was completed. And he was talking about it, as I say, for the last several decades of his ministry. He was warning this world, even when, as I said in that quote I gave to you, even when Germany was cut in two, even when half of Europe was under that communist rule of the USSR. But look at how dramatically, I mean, just look at how dramatic the changes were, even just within a few years after Mr. Armstrong's death in 1986, with the Berlin Wall coming down in 1989, the Soviet Empire collapsed in 1991, we'll talk more about Russia, the reemergence of Russia, in the next segment. But look at what God is saying. Look at how specific He is in this prophecy here in Revelation 17. This final resurrection will continue a short space. It's just going to be on the scene, dominating the world for some 2.5 years or so. It's an unsteady mixture of iron and clay, as it says in Daniel 2. But when it does rise in power, it's going to be all the strength and power of that Roman Empire of old. Verse 12 says, "And the 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings, which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast." That's referring to the United States of Europe. The 10 horns are a part of that seventh head, so they're contemporaneous. They're not successive like the heads. The heads are successive, but these 10 horns, these 10 kings, are on that seventh head. And again, it's the same as the 10 toes in Daniel 2. 10 heads of state in Europe joining together. 10 nations or groups coming together for 1 hour with the beast, for just a short time, a short space. So you can begin to see why we're so closely monitoring events in Europe. The referendum coming up for Britain in June, the refugee crisis, the financial crisis in Greece and other areas of Europe, and of course, German politics. And the strong man that's prophesied to come out of Germany. This is why we pay such close attention to these events. You don't hear this in any other radio program. I listen to a fair bit of talk radio, and of course all the ones in the United States. They're just obsessed with politics, with what's going on in politics, U.S. politics. There's not much of a world view. And I suppose it would vary from nation to nation. There's just not much of a world view. They don't see events in this world under the light of Bible prophecy like we do in this work, like we do in this church. This is from Süddeutsche Zeitung, following again on the elections from Sunday. This German publication, we had it translated by our news bureau. It asks, what happened in Germany on March 13th? What happened? What is it that happened on Sunday? It says, superficially, only the people of Baden-Württemberg, I'll probably pronounce these wrong in any event, Rhineland-Palatinate, and Saxony-Anhalt elected new state parliaments, these three regions where the elections occurred. It says, but what Germany experienced was not an ordinary election night. It was a night in which you could see in a few hours how much the country changed. It all changed in just a few hours, and one could feel how much it's still changing. See, it's happening so fast. It's so dramatic, these changes. The old ways which determined the political landscape of the Federal Republic for decades no longer apply. What was once certain is now uncertain. What was once considered impossible now seems likely. As I brought out yesterday, I mean, just a few months ago, you'd hear us sounding the alarm if some of these fringe party movements got 6, 7, 8% of the vote. Now they're up to 24%. Just in a matter of hours. So much change. And it's still changing, and dramatically so. What once was certain is now uncertain. What once seemed to be impossible, now it seems likely. That's what's happening in Germany. Is this significant? Well, go back to what Mr. Armstrong said about the seventh and final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. This comes from the local. Why German politics, as we know it, is crumbling. This is from yesterday, March 14th. The CDU weren't the only national party that got thumped in the elections. The Social Democrats also took a hefty beating. It says, for decades, these two parties dominated German politics, fighting between themselves for control of state and national parliaments. Something even more historic than the rise of the AfD happened in Baden-Württemberg. It says the Green Party became the biggest single party in the state, winning 30% of the vote. So that's the far-left party. The Environmentalist Party had previously controlled the state parliament despite having a smaller vote share than the CDU. Now they are the undisputed top dogs. It says this was the first time, listen to this, again, you talk about change and fast. This was the first time in post-1945 Germany that a party outside the big two took the largest amount of votes at a state election. And then this is how this piece concludes. Voters are no longer tribally attached to the two main parties and will switch from one party to the next based on current political issues or their attachment to specific politicians. The stage is being set. They're no longer tribally attached in Germany to the big two parties. It's all being set for them to grab hold of issues that are important to them and specific politicians. Who could those specific politicians be? That's what we'll be monitoring very closely over the course of this year and next. Dramatic changes. Dramatic changes. You could see it in just a few hours Sunday night. how much the country had changed. What once seemed impossible now seems likely. Now, let me take you back to this article. I quoted briefly from it just a moment ago. This is the September 1961 article, Giant World Power Rising Out of the Common Market. That's what it was called back then, the Common Market. Today you have the European Union, you have the common currency and all that. But in this piece, Mr. Armstrong talks about three developments that have brought this on. I mean, leaving aside Bible prophecy just for a second, he talked about how so many European nations had previously maintained prosperity by possessing colonies in Africa and Asia. But with the changing times, I mean, and losing those colonies, they also lost a source of prosperity and power. And then Mr. Armstrong talked about the two world wars that happened on European soil and how it left the continent ruined. Material destruction and also moral destruction. And writing this in 1961, he said you could see evidence of this destruction everywhere. It was obvious. And of course, at the time, all of the material destruction had been rebuilt by the United States, or at least thanks to United States funding. And then Mr. Armstrong talked about the surge in scientific and economic power coming from the United States on the one hand and the Soviet Union on the other, whereas the groups in Europe, the little disunited, helpless European nations, were sort of caught between these two powerful military giants. So, as he asks here, put yourself in the place of these people in Europe. He writes, they see their source of former prosperity torn from them. They see two prosperous world powers, one on each side of them, squeezing them in the middle. Up until now, these many little European nations have relied on the United States military and nuclear power to restrain the hungry Russian bear from devouring them. But United States prestige is being rapidly dragged in the dust and trampled down. I mean, this wouldn't really even seem that remarkable, this piece, were it written in 2016. But this was written in 1961. He says, all this leaves the nations of Europe uneasy. They've been taking a good look at themselves, and what do they see? They see many nations, each small compared to the mighty USSR at the border, yet if joined together as one empire possessing potential greater population, greater industrial and economic capacity, greater military power than either Russia or America, and yet here they are, robbed of their former source of prosperity, helpless, and why? Simply because they are divided. No one country by itself is strong enough to protect itself. They're all divided. They're weak. There's barriers everywhere. There's a different currency, different languages. He goes on and says, here are many nations, each speaking a different language. Their borders have been iron barriers. They've looked at one another in a spirit of jealousy, envy, competition, strife. Each has its own kind of money. Each has imposed heavy economic tariffs against the other. How is this going to change? It'll change when they let go of those divisions and they come together for a short space of time, for 1 hour. And yes, as Mr. Armstrong says, the United States and Great Britain, they were the ones who what? Proposed this, encouraged this. What a paradox, as he says. Proposed, encouraged, aided, and abetted by Ephraim and Manasseh, the United States and Britain. It's pretty amazing. Well, Mr. Armstrong says that twice in the 20th century, Germany tried to solve all these difficulties, these divisions, the strife between the nations in Europe, Germany tried to solve these difficulties by attempting to invade, conquer, and simply take over its neighbors. Take over the nations next door. First the Kaiser, then later Hitler. It says here, but now at last, this is in 1961, now at last, under the fear of Russian hordes on their doorstep, Germans, Italians, French, Dutch, Belgians, they began to realize how powerful they might become if they combined and pooled their resources. Now look at what's happened since he wrote this. Look at Europe today. Now it has its share of crises, as I covered yesterday. And Germany itself is economically vulnerable. And there's no strong man to lead. And it's going to have to be downsized. So there's more changes coming. But look, as that article about the elections on Sunday brought out, within a few hours, you could see how much the country had changed. Within just a few hours, that's how fast these developments are happening right now. Mr. Armstrong said here, they did not know. This is talking about, you know, the nations in Europe and the push for unity, for being united, for coming together. And then Mr. Armstrong says, they did not know what I knew back in 1934. I knew then that they were going to unite and resurrect the old Roman Empire. I had seen it in biblical prophecy. I knew it was sure. But these nations know nothing of Bible prophecy. They have no diabolical and evil thought in mind about creating the prophesied beast that is to fight against Christ at his return. They're natural, carnal-minded people who've only what they think of as the good motive of looking after their own welfare and interests. I mean, that's what's motivating it now. How can we come together? How can we be a stronger people? We've got to look after our own welfare. We've got to look after our own interests. He said, they're not starting this thing with any thought of doing evil to them. This is the way that seems right to man. And they do not know or believe, as the Bible states twice, that the end thereof are the ways of death. Notice over in Isaiah 10, just one more passage here before we break, Isaiah chapter 10. They don't know what it says there in those two proverbs. The end thereof are the ways of death. He says, finally, Mr. Armstrong does, it will be the death of their cherished Europe and of their civilization, but they are blissfully unaware of that. They don't know what Mr. Armstrong knew back as early as 1934, that the nations in the heart of Europe are going to unite. They're going to unite and resurrect the old Roman Empire. They don't know there's going to be this prophesied church-state union that we just read about there in Revelation 17. It's all laid out there for us. Notice what Isaiah 10 and verse 5 says. O Assyrian, the rod of my anger and the staff in their hand is my indignation. God's actually raising up this beast, or at least using this Assyrian rod as an instrument to correct his people. Verse 6, I will send him against a hypocritical nation. And against the people of my wrath will I give him a charge to take the spoil and to take the prey and to tread them down like the mire of the streets. Yes, this German-led empire, now forming in Europe, it's a tool in God's hands. God's going to use it as a rod to correct his people. See, these are the kinds of passages that really opened Mr. Armstrong's eyes to understand. This is about the seventh and final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. And so when we see titles or headlines along the way, like we saw last year, the Fourth Reich, what some Europeans see when they look at Germany, we want to tell you about it. We want to sound the alarm. We want to tell you that history's repeating itself. Bernard Connolly, remember, in The Rotten Heart of Europe, he said the European Union was just a cloak for German ambitions. I mean, they tried to do it by force in two world wars. That's the big picture perspective that Mr. Armstrong gave us in that article. They tried to do it by force. And now, I mean, now it's proposed, it's encouraged, it's aided and abetted by, of all people, the United States and Britain. We're the ones that got this project off and running. And now here we are in 2016. Now, going back to that quote I just gave to you, they didn't know what I knew back in 34. They didn't know that they were going to unite and resurrect that old Roman Empire. Notice what it says here in verse 7. This is Isaiah 10, verse 7. Howbeit, he means not so, neither does his heart think so. But it's in his heart to destroy and to cut off nations, not a few. I mean, they didn't go into it thinking that this was what would happen. But a mind change is going to happen. That's what Habakkuk 1 gets into. Look at the prophet Nahum as well, his prophecy. So much to cover. So many details. He, in his heart, he doesn't mean to carry this out. But what has been the history? What's been the history? And so when it says in a German publication, well, we saw a dramatic change in this nation just over the course of a few hours. We better sit up and take note when we read news stories like that. Just a few hours. Let me conclude here with what Mr. Armstrong said. Going back to this 1961 article, he said, in Europe, almost everybody takes it for granted. The common market is merely the economic start, that it will develop into a united government of European nations. But no one seems to know yet how. No one knows how this is going to come about. How is this going to happen? This is Herbert Armstrong writing 55 years ago. Okay, so there's a push for a common market, and that's the start. But how is this going to be brought along? It says the age-long, this is Mr. Armstrong, the age-long enemies, France and Germany, are now fused together, but only in economic trade that profits both. Would France trust a German to head a united government? Hardly. Would Germany accept a French ruler over them? Never. It says, prophecy says all seven revivals of the Roman Empire were to be headed by the Pope. The Vatican, you see, has to get involved and bring it all together, just like it says in Revelation 17. The woman straddles the beast. The woman is riding the beast. This is the only supreme authority that all of these disparate parts will find acceptable. And so you read about it, this church-state union, in Revelation 17 and in many other prophecies as well. Mr. Armstrong concludes here by saying, in the months and immediate years ahead, you are going to see prophecies literally leaping to life. That's what God's servant said 55 years ago in the September 1961 Plain Truth. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma. The live stream is available at the KPCG website, kpcg.fm, and also thetrumpet.com. Send us your emails to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
Well, yesterday, Vladimir Putin announced that Russia had accomplished its mission in Syria. This is what The Guardian had to say. Russia's exit from Syria, well, in its headline, and just talked about how few analysts saw this coming. Nobody expected it. The Guardian says 5.5 months, 9,000 fighter jet sorties, a reprieve for Bashar al-Assad's regime, the downing of a Russian passenger jet over Egypt, and the end forever of the burgeoning bromance between the Turkish and Russian presidents. Thus goes the summary of Russia's intervention in Syria, which was irrevocably changed, which has irrevocably changed the contours of the five-year-old conflict and its surrounding geopolitics. It quotes Vladimir Putin here saying, "I consider the objectives that have been set for the defense ministry to be generally accomplished." Putin announced matter-of-factly on Monday evening, announcing the imminent withdrawal of Russian troops from Syria. Now, ISIS is still there, of course. So what is it that Russia's mission was? I mean, what was the mission? Putin says, "I consider the objectives to be generally accomplished." Well, continuing in the piece, this is The Guardian, "For while it is true the mission of defeating ISIS has not been accomplished, nobody who has taken the most cursory glance at the map of where Russian bombs landed would have believed this to be the real mission." See, this wasn't the mission anyway. Now, we've gone through this before with you, but still, it's worth reiterating here. That wasn't the mission from the beginning, to take out ISIS. It was to prop up Assad. And more than that, it was to prop up Russia as well. It says even the goal of propping up the Syrian state institutions to keep Bashar al-Assad in power and prevent the kind of power vacuum seen in Libya and Iraq after their leaders were deposed was secondary, according to many analysts. Nobody, this is quoting an analyst, nobody wanted to deal with Russia after Ukraine. And the goal of the Syria campaign was to force the West to deal with Russia again. That was the goal of this campaign. Now Russia's a player again. This analyst says this has happened, and now they're getting out of the conflict with minimal losses. I think it's a pretty brilliant tactical move. Now the international nations, I mean, they have to deal with Russia again, whether with respect to Syria, the Middle East, Ukraine, whatever it might be. Nobody wanted to deal with them after what they did in Ukraine. But now Russia's back. And now they're getting out of the conflict. And now Putin's announcing that mission is accomplished. And they've gotten out of the conflict, as this analyst brings out, with minimal losses. Another brilliant tactical move on the part of Vladimir Putin. You go back to October of 2015, just last year, this was a few months ago. Notice what President Obama had to say about Putin's venture in Syria.
"And I said to Mr. Putin that I'd be prepared to work with him if he is willing to broker with his partners, Mr. Assad and Iran, a political transition. We can bring the rest of the world community to a brokered solution, but that a military solution alone, an attempt by Russia and Iran to prop up Assad and try to pacify the population, is just going to get them stuck in a quagmire. And it won't work. And they will be there for a while if they don't take a different course. So these are hard challenges. They are ones that we are going to continue to pursue. The top line message that I want everybody to understand is we are going to continue to go after ISIL. We are going to continue to reach out to a moderate opposition. We reject Russia's theory that everybody opposed to Assad is a terrorist. We think that is self-defeating. It will get them into a quagmire. It will be used as a further recruitment tool for foreign fighters."
But as quagmires go, as Brett Stevens said at the Wall Street Journal, Mr. Putin will take it. I mean, if this is what we feel like is a quagmire, Russia's back. Russia's calling the shots. Russia went in there and said, "Yeah, okay, I know you guys don't like ISIS, but Anyone opposing Assad is a terrorist. And just look at where they dropped the bombs. Just look at who they went after. And now, 5.5 months or so on, they pull out, or at least they announce they're going to pull out. As to how much they pull out or how their involvement is diminished, I guess we'll wait and see. But they do it with minimal losses. This is what Brett Stevens said in his piece. Having established these facts on the ground, Mr. Assad is now well-placed to exploit the U.S.-Russia-brokered Syrian peace talks. Mr. Assad can continue his offensive against the opposition while making few diplomatic concessions. Mr. Putin has also consolidated his alliance with Iran while diminishing U.S. influence. I mean, it's no wonder, he said. Mission accomplished. I consider the objectives, and I think we've generally accomplished them. Stephen says, by withdrawing some forces, or at least appearing to, Mr. Putin is also hoping to coax concessions from the U.S. and Europe. The Russian wants the West to ease its sanctions against Russia for snatching Ukrainian territory. And he knows Mr. Obama is looking for a way to get back to business as usual with Russia. I mean, this has been his way. Whether it's in dealing with the mullahs in Iran, whether it's in propping up the Castro regime in Cuba, he wants business as usual with these tyrants, with these dictators. It's nothing for him, as I covered yesterday, to criticize Mr. Cameron, to criticize, you know, other European leaders, to criticize Benjamin Netanyahu for sure. But he wants business as usual with all the aggressors, with all the ones that are sponsoring terrorist acts and other belligerent behavior. It says the withdrawal announcement may be an attempt to give Mr. Obama diplomatic cover for one more reset in relations before Mr. Obama leaves the White House. That's what the likely outcome will be here. Another reset by Mr. Obama. It says Russia's intervention won't end the Syrian civil war. The Islamic State still controls much of the country, but countering terrorism never was Mr. Putin's goal. He wanted to show the world that Russia stands by its allies and to acquire new leverage in the Middle East and Europe. Any more such quagmires, and he'll be back sipping cocktails at the next G8 summit. What did Russia want going in? It wanted to show the world that it stands by its allies. Quite unlike the United States. It stands by its allies, and it wanted to acquire new leverage in the Middle East and Europe. And it wanted to diminish America's influence in the region. Has Putin accomplished this? He certainly has. You think about that prophecy in Ezekiel 38 that we've talked about here in the last couple of years, the Prince of Rosh, the strong man that's going to come out of the heart of Asia, another strong man. I mean, again, if you step back and look at this article Mr. Armstrong wrote in 1961 and the power of the USSR at the time, and then all of that came crashing down, right there in the early 1990s, and then throughout the 1990s, I mean, Russia was way outside the mainstream of world affairs. I mean, Russia had collapsed. Russia didn't matter. Russia had no power. And look at what's happened since Vladimir Putin became president in 2000. Have things changed dramatically? Well, it's like that article on the German elections. You can look at what happened in just 5.5 months. Russia's involvement there in the Syrian civil war. And see dramatic changes on the world stage. Certainly within that region. I mean, Putin himself called the Soviet Union's collapse the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. This is a man who's dedicated to reversing that catastrophe, to rebuilding the Russian Empire. And I'd say he's had some success in that. It's all prophesied. You'll have to study Ezekiel 38 on your own time. Search that at thetrumpet.com. Look at what my father has written about this leader, about the reemergence of Russia as a great power on this earth. Russia is prophesied to fulfill a huge role in world affairs leading up to the return of Jesus Christ. And just its rise in power itself is provoking alarm and urgency within Europe. This is one of the many crises that Europe is facing. You have all the economic crises, you have the refugee crisis, and you have the reemergence of Russia from the East. You can be sure that all of these bold moves, even as the United States is in the midst of a stunning decline, these bold moves by Putin and Russia will only hasten along this European beast power, the formation of this beast. The ten kings, the ten groups. Just in a few hours Sunday night, we saw a dramatic change take place in Germany. Germans are going to be crying out for a strong leader. And will all the other nations that join together with Germany just embrace that leader? Well, as Mr. Armstrong said, even if they don't, you have this spiritual power, or this religious group, this religious figure, this religious head that's going to come along, that all the nations that come together, these ten, they'll find him acceptable. And they'll come together for a short space, for 1 hour, and they'll be of one mind. That's what your Bible says. Let's just conclude this program, switching back to that piece in The Atlantic last week. Again, some revealing statements made in that long interview, or that long article, based upon hours and hours of interviews. But these two articles that I have here are basically responses to Jeffrey Goldberg's piece about the Obama Doctrine, I think is what it was titled. This one here, Barack Obama's Revolution in Foreign Policy. This is also printed in The Atlantic. And it says here, it's a criticism I've heard from more than one person who has worked with President Obama that he regards himself as the smartest person in the room, any room. Jeffrey Goldberg's fascinating article reveals that this is a considerable understatement. The president seems to think he's the smartest person in the world, perhaps ever. It says here, power corrupts in subtle ways. It appears to have made Obama arrogant, as described in Goldberg's story. He's impatient to the point of rudeness with members of his own administration. Well, it gets into some of the specifics later, but it just brought to mind that proverb, pride comes before the fall. Imagine coming into a room and just being so sure that you know more, that you're the smartest one there, that you have all the answers, that all of your policies, all of your plans are going to work out. Coming back to Bret Stephens, that previous piece I had from the Wall Street Journal was just from someone else. This was the Bret Stephens piece that I had, actually. He titled it, Barack Obama Checks Out. And says, I was a bit late reading Mr. Goldberg's long article, The Obama Doctrine, which appeared last week and is based on hours of conversation with the president, along with ancillary interviews with John Kerry, Hillary Clinton, Leon Panetta, Manuel Valls of France, Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel, and other bold-faced names. It says, kudos to Mr. Goldberg for his level of access, the breadth of his reporting, the sheer volume of juicy quotes and revealing details. Still, Brett Stevens says. It's a deep dive into a shallow mind. It says Mr. Obama's recipe for Sunni-Shiite harmony in the Middle East. The two sides, says Mr. Obama, need to find an effective way to share the neighborhood, sounding like Mr. Rogers. That's the solution to this Sunni-Shia chaos in the Middle East. We need to share the neighborhood. We need to be good neighbors. And what about the mess in Libya, brought on by U.S.-led intervention? Goldberg's piece quotes Mr. Obama saying, "I had more faith in the Europeans." Brett Stevens says, it sounds like a 12-year-old blaming a 6-year-old sister for chores not done. What about the recipe for better global governance? If only everyone could be like the Scandinavians, this would all be easy, Mr. Obama says. These are the solutions. These are the deep thoughts of the leader of the free world, the leader of the United States. It says, then there's Mr. Obama, the political theorist. Real power means you can get what you want without having to exert violence. That's what President Obama believes. He said that in connection to Vladimir Putin's gambles in Ukraine and Syria. Now try telling Vladimir Putin that, look, we have the real power here. We have the real power in Syria. The United States has the real power in the Middle East because we've been able to accomplish what we've wanted without having to exert violence or resort to violence. And meanwhile, Putin just continues his march, gobbling up parts of Ukraine, intervening in Syria. 5.5 months just bombing to smithereens. Those rebel groups, those U.S.-sponsored, those U.S. allies, those rebel groups that resisted against Assad. 5.5 months on, he gets out and says, I think we've pretty much fulfilled our objectives here. And then finally, this last bit from Brett Stevens, it says, as for those allies, Mr. Obama treats the Saudis with such naked contempt that it prompted former intelligence minister Turkey Al-Faisal to denounce the president in an op-ed. Could it be, the prince asked, that you are petulant about the kingdom's efforts to support the Egyptian people when they rose against the Muslim Brotherhood's government and you supported it? There's lots of strong condemnation coming out of the Middle East, coming out of Europe, aimed at the American leadership, aimed at this administration, even as it presses forward with all of its cherished ideals, with its agenda, fighting global warming, propping up dictators, and so on. Well, all of this, too, when you talk about the demise, the decline of American power, Leviticus 26, and also Deuteronomy 28. It's spelled out in so much detail. That's what we've touched on here today. Just the many details that God gives to us regarding the rise of the beast out of Europe, that church-state union, the union of 10 kings, the Prince of Rosh in Asia. Well, there's many other prophecies that we go into on other occasions on this program. We obviously don't have time to get into all of those. And as I look at the clock, we are running out of time on today's program. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on 101.3 on the FM dial, headquartered in Edmond, Oklahoma. The live stream you can get at thetrumpet.com. Send us your emails, td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you again tomorrow.